This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Lukes here at The Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome my guest from America, United States. Welcome, Mark Anderson.
Hello, Arnie. I might not have the best image or sound. Hopefully, it'll be okay. I'm not
actually in not far north Queensland, but I'm in North Queensland on the east coast. I'm in the tropics. If you see behind me, you'll see the ferns or the palms or whatever is there, and the humidity's up. We're at a caravan park, a village, if you like. Because of course the down south is the winter. The rains, the cold, and here we are traveling 2 or 3 days north, all within the continent of Australia, and we've moved to the tropics. A balmy 24, 25, but the humidity's up. But it is interesting, because in the course of our travels, of course, there are we're meeting people. Their point of view, their grounding as to the current situation of the world and how things are actually looking in their part of ship. And every day aware of in Queensland is the Queenslanders. There's nothing like Queenslanders. If you meet two Queenslanders, you've got two points of view, you've got two perspectives on life, you've got two answers to solutions. It's their own way. And even though the big city, Brisbane, might have 2 or 3 million, probably 3 million in it, the fact is those that once you move outside the city, those in the villages, in the townships, and that are the ones that I'm more keenly interested in, because they seem to, so very, very important. One of the books that I've been promoting, there's a link there called is The Constitutional Barriers to Serfdom by Eric D. Butler. It's really a pamphlet of some 60 pages or something like that. I've got a copy of it here. And yes, it's what is it, 34 something pages on the internet, the PDF. Very, very important booklet, because in its 24 pages, thank you, Claude, in its 24 pages, it's what it's doing is it's reinforcing that if we are to bring government back to order, then we need to actually think about, as they did in 1215, they thought about their ancient rights and freedoms, the encoding of their ancient rights. So very important to actually consider. The limiting constitution and the erosion of that agreement. This past 122 years, the erosion of this agreement. And Eric's argument, of course, is that the purpose of the constitution, the functions within it, the separations of powers, all those sorts of points of view, legal points, what we're seeing is an intrusion of government into every area of our life, and in particular, the imposition of what we correctly refer to as world government, an entity, a power, attempting to operate over and above all nation states and all nation state constitutions, an entity or a power moving into a realm where constitutions are no longer valid. And of course, this is something that Australia, of course, is in a muddled-headed position, because we're discussing the voice. So those are my opening thoughts, Mark. And no doubt there are narratives going on in your neck of the woods, and I'm keenly interested in your essentially establishing thoughts as to what's going on in your part of the world.
Well, one thing that occurred to me today, Arnie, was Joe Biden, the so-called president, some say alleged president of the United States, was in Ukraine working out Ukraine's problems, giving U.S. tax dollars, or preparing to do so, ever more to Ukraine, and to a reasonable degree, wide open. Mm-hmm. What's going on there is the idea of internationalism, the idea where a leader thinks that beyond his borders is just as much his jurisdiction and concern as within his borders, and that's if that politician, let's say president, even really truly recognizes his country's borders at all. The internationalist is the real scourge of the world. We've heard over and over again that internationalism is a far more dangerous and precarious and perilous philosophy, because it's completely malleable, it's completely capricious and arbitrary, and so-called leaders like Biden can just sort of roll the dice or move the chessmen wherever they want and say, well, tomorrow Botswana is Mike, and constantly moving chess pieces around. Everything is a concern except his own country. Mm-hmm. The amount of time that Biden spends on these things is extraordinary, really, not to mention the money. But, you know, this is one issue that kind of dovetails into what you're talking about, this blind loyalty to something to manage the affairs of other countries. Yes, you have relations with other countries through the Foreign Service, but it goes beyond just interacting and sharing a few ideas or advice. It goes on to where the United States is sort of the de facto superintendent over the nations. But meanwhile, and I reported this recently on ukcolumn.org, where I do a regular Monday report, they had the Ukraine Recovery Conference, which did not get anywhere near the publicity, Arnie, that Biden's junket mass of NGOs, civil society, so-called stakeholders, we've heard this globalized discussion and language before, hedge fund managers, IMF, World Bank, and very little, if any, conventional media publicity was afforded to this Ukraine Recovery Conference earlier this month in London, even though major politicians such as the PM of the UK were there. We hear about, you know, the NATO meeting in Vilnius, Lithuania, and we hear about Biden going to Ukraine, but we don't hear about the Ukraine Recovery Conference, which had dozens of such leaders and corporate heads and banker heads. They call it governance. Always beware when you hear the word governance. Not government, governance. It's a different nuance. It's a different thing, especially in the modern era. And so the think tanks are heavily plugged in, and this is where the real decisions are being made through this new presidium and sort of loose-knit legislature of these nations that are beholden to these financial and corporate interests. This is where the decisions are really being made, and that's where the least of the publicity is. And from that, most of the world has drifted. Their constitutions are really more like museum relics, if you will. Mm-hmm. Not that it's beyond hope, I don't mean that, but nevertheless, it's quite troubling. They don't just flout or ignore the current constitutions of different nations. They also engage in completely different extra-constitutional illegal gatherings for which they have little or no authority to even engage in the first place. When the U.S. didn't just approve a treaty, it didn't make an agreement between nations. The U.S. joined a government, the U.N., which has a world court, a general assembly, and a titular leader of some sort, the general secretary, secretary general of the United Nations. And so there, nowhere in the U.S. Constitution is the U.S. government authorized to join another government. Mm-hmm. And that's not an opinion. And
I was looking at the relationship that Australia took, the actual policy that Australia took during COVID and the lockdown, and of course the World Health Organization and their vested interests, unfortunately vested interests, and it really was commercial interests that were driving policy. The Bill Gates and Fauci's, while they appear frontmen, of course they're frontmen for a whole industry, and that is Big Pharma. And the World Health Organization policy that they were suggesting every nation in the world should implement was to utilise the, unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Australian morbidity, Australian mortality rate is up 20%. 1 in 5 increase. It's up 20% on previous years. So that means that this solution offered is actually a very dangerous solution, and unfortunately, it's the roll of the dice as to whether, if you have had it, as to the effects of it, the long-term effects, and whether the probability, the chances of actually dying from the medical treatment, is actually amplified. And that, to me, is extraordinary, that the policies haven't changed in the sense of our aged care facility. The jab and everything that went with it, of course, was espoused as this will serve it. Well, we've got political leaders diving for cover. We've got state leaders resigning because they were instrumental in forcing, not compelling, not mandating, physically forcing people to take this medication, and subsequent deaths are going through the roof. So, of course, that political leader ultimately is responsible for that sort of behaviour. It really is extraordinary that these are the things that are transpiring. And, of course, what it does is it defies logic. It certainly defies medical logic. I went in my massage. I achieved a medical provider number, and so the qualification was recognised through the public health insurance scheme. And I was able to actually administer remedial massage, and the costs were subsidised. The point is, what's the point? The point is that the very basic training that goes with even a remedial masseuse is that you're looking at predispositions. In other words, what's your current status? What do you have? What are your current ailments or responses to certain types of balms and things like that, or to what's the status of your muscle? Are you subject to any type of muscular degeneration? All the sorts of things, these contraindications, predispositions, and of course reactions, potential for reactions to anything that I might be applying or methods that I might be using. I have to continually maintain a degree of professionalism in that you have to constantly be updated as to the latest thoughts, the latest medical perspectives, the latest approaches to your particular discipline. And the last thing that you would ever do is have a general rule, and especially for even an age group of people, but of course the diverse perspective from different ages comes into it, to genders comes into it, to metabolism, muscle metabolism, and of course you, from an infant to an aged care person, is such a plethora, such a range of perspectives. You can't have a general rule, let alone a general application of any sort of medical procedure across such variable circumstances. You've got 7,000 million people on this earth, and you've got 7,000 specific form of medical application in massage, which is really, when you think about it, is it so intrusive or onerous or difficult? As long as you apply gentle pressure, you should be able to do lots of things, even to a newborn babe. And I find it interesting because I actually also massage, things like that. So you take into account all these variables, and yet here it is that we've got the highest authority, supposedly commercial authority at least in the world, that are advocating one treatment for everyone. One treatment, this is it, this is the answer to everything that's going on at the moment, and you take our treatment, and I think, of course, it's medical folly. It's really is such an abhorrent situation. It's against all medical ethics, and it's against common sense. Common sense. I can't treat you nor your wife the same. I have to treat you and your wife as individuals, and a world policy. To have a world policy, to me, has demonstrated with COVID an absolute failure. It has demonstrated a complete failure, and here we have an increase in morbidity of 20% in Australia. So whatever the number was, we've got a 20% increase on that, and that's absolutely extraordinary. We've got to look at this very, very hard, and we've got to consider, did government operate outside their level of authority? Did they operate in an area that they are actually not authorised to operate in? So the question then comes is, well, what solutions, what remedies do we have? And this is where we look to our limiting constitution. We look to the document, and in Australia, the constitution says in particular that as to as to not, I've got the Constitution here, I could look it up and read, but essentially as to essentially provide any medical conscription. In other words, it has done. The very thing that the Commonwealth government is not allowed to do, it has done. And that to me is very important. It's very important because we've got to look to those combative barristers, those elites within the universities who understand what the limiting constitution is about. We've got, or even if they do, there's still the area of the actual citizenry that the citizenry has an obligation to mobilize itself to bring about significant restoration of our ancient rights and freedoms that are upheld within our constitution. So the citizenry, the active citizenry, it's now in a massive demonstration of some hundreds of thousands, perhaps, or even more, in Canberra. And the outcome of that demonstration, people travelling from all areas of Australia to get to Canberra, demonstrated over a period that was there, and the outcome? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nothing actually changed as a consequence of all that financial, all of that, what would you call it, the actual energy that goes into transporting people, hundreds of thousands of people into Canberra to demonstrate, house them, feed them, and then for them to go back home again. All of that, not only political, but financial and actual hydrogen perspective that I actually want to restate the seminar that was held in Adelaide the weekend before last, nearly 2 weeks ago tomorrow. The seminar was a two-day seminar and had Augusto Zimmerman, who is a constitutional law professor from Sheridan in West Australia. He is a former law commissioner. And alongside him was Robert Belzola. Robert Belzola is a solicitor. He resides in Sydney. He practices law. He has been before the Supreme Court, New South Wales and Queensland, I believe. And he is also at times before the Federal Court of Australia and the High Court, the highest court in Australia, is before the High Court. And they're on the floor for basically roughly 4 hours apiece across the 2 days, 2 hours each speaker across 2 days. And those lectures had a very active question and answer session at the end of the paper. Now, if you go to the Crossroads website, and I want to actually reinforce this, the Crossroads website, thank you, Claude, what you'll find is not only are the lectures there, but also links to the PowerPoint presentations. So if there's something that you actually want to see, actually, they may not be in Crossroads. They could be in Rumble, excuse me. The Rumble video channel, that's where they are. And if you go to the Rumble video channel, you'll find the PowerPoint link. So you just cursor down a bit, Claude. There it is, the PowerPoint link. So the MP3 is there, but the link to the PowerPoint. You can actually download their slides and go through those slides one at a time. So that if the professor or the solicitor, Robert, and to me that is absolutely brilliant, that is the case. That is what they actually are providing. That information, so it is readily available to you, readily available for you to actually do your own research and consideration of what these experts in the law and our constitution. And of course, if you can bring me back up, please, Claude, I've got two books here. This one was actually Augusto was promoting on the day, and that's Emergency Powers, COVID-19 Restrictions and Mandatory Vaccination, A Rule of Law Perspective of 19, both by Augusto Zimmerman, and he has other authors assisting him in writing it. But the thing is that Augusto is such a, I mean, seriously, what a great mind. What a great mind. To be listening to a modern-day genius working through the law, understanding he's able to place this act, this period of time, this quote from that particular individual, and then he just goes, and it was delightful to watch it, listen to it, and of course, because these records are there, others can go through it. The point that I'm trying to reinforce today is that we have a document. It's called our Constitution, and the document is being ignored. It is an agreement between the people and the government as to how the people shall be governed. It's a limiting constitution. It has actually defined the only powers that the Commonwealth is authorised to exercise legislation in. And of course, what we're finding is that since 1983, the Franklin Dam issues powers massively expanded these powers of the Commonwealth. And it is to this area that the citizenry must turn. It is actually that that our constitution must be upheld, and that these issues that the activist High Court have determined on their own personal will, they have decided to undo our constitution. So it is the people who must actually bring back the limiting power of the constitution. It is the people who actually must insist, as they did in 1215 with Magna Carta. The barons did. But the thing is that the citizenry were behind the barons, and the church was involved with the barons, that it should all be brought back to order, that the tyrant of that day, King John, be called to order. And of course, there's no point. What have I heard said before? There's no point if you've got all the ideas, but you don't have the sanctions. You actually need to have the sanctions. To me, the sanctions against government are the vote, but it's also in deconstructing confidence in the actual representative, that if they're not being effective in the parliament, if they're not actually representing the electorate, then to me the sanction is that we've got to work vigorously to actually put so much pressure on our representatives that they yield, that even in spite of their personal viewpoint, they yield. They actually yield behind their voice. And that to me is the critical part. When we talk about mainstream media, and mainstream media should be defunded or disenfranchised, the citizenry has to take into account is that they need to generate their own media. And it was interesting talking to the different groupings as we're travelling, that in those creative initiatives that each group was actually looking at, there's such a variety, such a plethora of approaches. There are Facebooks, there are Telegrams, there are signals and things like that, discussion groups. But how do you actually break outside your own box? How do you break outside your own silo of influence and start having a say? And to me, that's an area, an opportunity for creative initiative, an opportunity for work. How do you have your say in the local community about current issues, about the excesses of government? How do you have your say? Well, two or three people with a particular signs, and they just pick it during the peak hours in the morning and the afternoon to actually pass a message on to their fellow citizens, a message that about things that might be thought signs along the road. And the signs along the road are actually to bring up trivia questions, to ask you a question. And there are three you can work out this trivia question. The second sign is the trivia question. And what it's got is it's got a theme about it, whether it's how to pronounce the local thought within someone. And finally, the third sign is the correct pronunciation for that or the answer to the question. And so, to me, these type of initiatives are, if you're correctly spaced out, you could be asking the question, are you happy with your government? Are you happy with your politician? Are you happy that your politician is pursuing this particular line? And, of course, you'd start asking that question, and you start asking it in a busy area where people are driving to and from work. And then it becomes a discussion topic at Smoko and lunch. He's did that, and George did this, and all of a sudden George's popularity goes through the floor because George is being held to account. And to me, the idea of representation is that politicians should be held to account every single day, but not just politicians. There's this whole question of the bureaucracy behind it, and of course those people who have access to our politicians who attempt to influence them, the lobbyists. This is phenomenal. This is an American system being introduced to Australia. The lobbyists, and of course big pharma, big industry, big banks, whatever, they can afford to have a lobbyist for every single politician out there. They can afford it, and they do have lobbyists, and these are professional lobbyists who make sure that the politician knows the view of that particular entity. But what about the politician knowing the view of the electorate? But in the end, of course, they forget about it. They absolutely do. They realise that, yes, I can have a say. I can actually not sit on my hands and only tick a box 1 year out of three or four, but I can actually do something every single day, even if it's just thinking up that question, that thought-provoking question, and to see what the public thinks. Because, of course, after a couple of weeks of doing this, you might actually test the feedback, which is what the big marketeers do, and go to a local market, and then respond to the question to see if your question has been effective. But you can use science against them, because they certainly use science against you. Your thoughts, please, Mark Anderson.
Yeah, checking the juice on my tablet here. It's a little. Let me see here. Okay, there was the problem. This August will be the third anniversary of a dear friend of mine who passed away. He was a social credit, Douglas social credit monetary reform supporter, Bob Van Bemelen. Mm-hmm. And he and I would discuss some of the low level communication, you know, talking at the breakfast diner, discussing things over coffee, and all of that's good and well, and we don't want it to stop. We want it to grow. But how do you get beyond that? And of course, you look at the negative side of the equation, and every effort is made by the oligarchic plutocratic establishment that has private governance running governments. Every effort is made through their mass media syndicate to give the protection. They hand out the protection or provide the protection for the corrupt politician, and they tend to savage and attack the good ones. And so you tend to have bad statesmen in office forever, and good ones can barely ever get anywhere. There's an old saying, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. And we often feel that way, and it can be quite distressing and depressing. But on the positive side of the equation, me and known as the town hall meeting. Mm-hmm. Now, the town hall meeting is still a living tradition, at least last I knew, in the northeastern seaboard of the United States, states like Vermont and New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. In the earlier colonial days of the United States, obviously there was no internet or any kind of broadcast medium. There was just the written word. And the spoken that are appointed officials and government people, but oftentimes it was just the citizenry, and there may or may not have been the involvement of actual government-serving people, people serving in government at the time. It could be more trivial matters, like maybe how to pave the road, how are we going to pay for it, how are we going to do it? Or it could be, we have despotism in our midst, and what are we going to do? At one time it was Eve. Has a lot of potential still in any country with any kind of reasonable democratic tradition. Imagine, if you will, and your local government, like where I'm at now is my mother's house, and the local government most close to home is Lake Charter Township.
Yeah.
They have a hall there. And because my mom is a taxpayer and I've been a resident here a long time until I moved to Texas primarily, because of that, the Lake Township Hall, where the Charter Township Board not charge a fee, or it would be a very minimal fee, and it would be our right as citizens to use their spacious hall, mm-hmm. to have a meeting, not on their day-to-day or week-to-week or month-to-month township discussion items, but on broader items, on more critical items, mm-hmm. monetary reform, what's going on, what are all these Federal Reserve rate hikes, interest rate hikes, what are they really doing? The notion that continually raising rates is going to fight inflation is comically and tragically inaccurate. There's almost no truth to that at all. It's amazing that they sell that BS. Just a town hall meetings and how popular that could be. A lot of people are very tired of television. A lot of people are more and more untrustworthy of the media syndicate, as well they should be. Before long, the alternative media, at least development, because that can get a lot of those barriers out of the way. I believe the barriers were mentioned by the writer you mentioned at the beginning of the show. Well, barriers are something that you clear, right? Obstacles are stuff that you want to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. Well, we want to get the mass media syndicate out of the way so we can get town hall meetings. We're tired of it. We're not going to put up with it anymore. Okay. You know, and my late friend Bob was even more adamant than me. You know, there comes a time when you just got to get mad and say, yep, pass the southern border. There's laws on the books to control and secure the border. Then you go secure the border. No prevarication. There's nothing else to discuss. Refuse to carry out their sworn duty. And the town hall meetings could focus on this. You could say, we're not concerned about whether this person's Democrat or Republican. They have an oath, a sworn duty to do this, this, and this, and they're not doing it. And what are we going to do about it?
Yep.
And so the town hall meeting, I think, is that keeps us siloed. And a friend of mine, Dick Eastman, who's a pretty smart retired economics instructor, lives out in Washington State. He's a pretty astute guy. And I'll make sure to send him this show so he sees his honorable mention. And cost effective as that is, and it's always an important tool, like your archive video of that meeting, mm-hmm, it would have still been better had many, many people been at that meeting in person. And what's to say that you shouldn't have more of those meetings that you just got done having, where Oliver Haydorn was among those speakers and the law professor that you mentioned was among the speakers. We'd like to see, we should like to see something like that happening once a quarter, once every other month. Make it into kind of a quasi lecture town hall meeting. Something's to be done and discuss what needs to be discussed. So kudos, Arnie, for having that discussion at that Adelaide, I believe you called it. And we need to see much more of that in the form of a kind of a town hall meeting. And yes, those that can't make it can tune in via live stream and watch it online. The internet's a good tool, but don't make the internet the sole thing, because that is partly why things get siloed in the first place. Everybody kind of has their own little camp or their little community in cyberspace, and it's hard for the twain to meet, as the old saying goes. It's hard for everything to cross-pollinate. As cost-effective as it is, and you know, efficient as it is, and to the extent that I've engaged in town hall type meetings, they've been very robust. They can be even a little bit argumentative, but better that than it's better to have some argument than it is to have people just in a malaise, you know, just completely resigned to their fate, no motivation. And so I'll let you comment from there, Arnie. I have to check on something momentarily here at the house. But that's what I see. I'll be back in a moment. But go ahead and address what I had to say.
No worries. Thank you for that, Mark. Very, very important. You've opened up some thoughts that I had. And actually, you've, in your own way, he attends the Supreme Court in New South Wales and I believe also in Queensland and the Federal Court of Australia and also the High Court of Australia. So Robert is a well-versed solicitor. And he's very thorough in his approach. And what Robert was speaking about in particular was in South Australia, local government. Local council elections found itself in the position where a significant number of candidates for the local government election had failed to declare pecuniary interests and donations from sources outside. And so this particular requirements that they are aware of who made donations to this candidate, who was backing them, and that sort of thing. So of course that assisted the public in understanding the who was behind the scenes, if you like, pulling the strings on the candidates, who was actually supporting them in significant financial manner. And this requirement, this declaration, wasn't adhered to by a good many of the candidates, and those candidates got up, including mayoral positions, deputy mayors, etc. Those candidates got up. The question then comes in, how does the state government deal with it? Well, the state government in South Australia decided to write a new law and to backdate it, to retrospectively apply it. And this to me is very important, that the law did not exist other than the requirement existed. And then retrospectively, the requirement was dropped. And of course, that is absurd because the law is there for all men and it's a consistent law. It's a stable law. It's written, it's promulgated You've got to understand it and you have to apply it and adhere to it. These aspiring candidates did not. They failed to declare those things which were necessary to declare. And rather than have a whole swag of new elections for those local government areas, the state government changed the law. It actually brought in a new law. So Robert was arguing about the retrospectivity of law and how it is such an unstable and it's a false, if you like, false perspective that the law as it stood, as it stands, has to be upheld. And so Robert argued. And of course, who was interested mostly in these things, amongst other things, were local government candidates. And some of them achieved their seats. Those who are acting in the realm of local government, those who are actually finding it increasingly difficult to have a voice at the local government level, would do well to listen to those two videos presented. Important is this perspective of upholding law. We the people and the state of our constitution was the title for the seminar. So well done, Public Speakers Club in Adelaide, for having put that on. And of course, the third speaker there was Oliver Haydorn, PhD, Oliver Haydorn, and the role of the public authority in economic life. Excuse me, his books are actually all on our front page on the website. They're all there, and you can actually find links there that'll take you to distributors for those books and purchase yourself a copy of it. But listen to Dr. Haydorn by other World Economic Forum players, other United Nations players, in particular Klaus Schwab. You will own nothing and be happy. In other words, the economic realm is a closed shop. You're not going to participate in it. You're not going to own anything. If you're required to do something, you will be encouraged through their surveillance state score and all the things that go on with it. A most insidious sort of perspective. And to me the idea of taking and how we're losing our ancient rights and freedoms. For most people, this is an unsatisfactory outcome. As they experiencing the imposition of greater and greater tyranny, this is an unacceptable result. And so to me, the area of concern, the area of my particular interest, is to direct people to the correct avenue of their attention, and that is by upholding their constitution, by actually getting a copy of your pocket constitution, which we've got some pocket copies around here. I'm just looking for one if I could illustrate it. I don't have it here. Yes, I do, right here. I've got this is the previous version of the pocket constitution, but you can get the latest version from the current government, issued by the current government with their first 18 pages of propaganda. But the fact is that the Constitutional Act is in there, and it's there for you to read and to study and to mull over. And you realise that if you're reading the Constitution, it gives you some idea of why world government is such an unhealthy perspective. Because our constitution is based on houses of parliament, the lower house and the upper house, and the monarch. So there are three, if you like, equal areas, divisions of power. And that, to me, very, very important. We also have other divisions, and that is the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. The legislative produces the law. The executive administers the law. And the judiciary adjudicates the executive as to whether it's actually constitutional for them to be doing things based on our limiting constitution. Now, when our high court has been filled with political activists and we've had a 4-3 majority on a critical issue such as Franklin Dam, then we've got to consider the ramifications of those activist judges and how they actually, is it circumscribed? Is that the right word? They essentially emasculated, they castrated the strength of our constitution, of its limiting powers, defined limiting powers written and recorded within section 51, 52. These defined limiting powers are so, so important because the Commonwealth is now acting outside these limiting powers and it needs to be brought back. And the only way to do that, as the barons insisted in 1215, we have to insist that these limiting powers must be upheld, and that the High Court does not have the authority. The High Court has actually acted outside its locus standi, its legitimate authority to undo our Constitution. And this High Court needs to be actually pulled back into line. So we've got issues with really three branches of government: the political, the bureaucratic, the administrative, and the judiciary. We've got issues at all three branches of government, and we need to pull all three branches back into line. This, to me, is the challenge of this age. And I think it's most important that if we are to be a free people, we've got to consider these areas of activity. And in my mind, to my mind, these areas are entirely political. They are within the scope of every individual to become active, to understand their constitution, and to do their darndest to cause their political class to uphold the limiting powers of our constitution, and then to move out and bring the bureaucrats that are undoing our limiting powers as listed in the constitution. So it really is to me it is a call. Is it a call to arms? Certainly intellectual arms, a call to the spirit to pursue freedom. This to me is the call of this age. Are we up to it? Are we of a culture that is sufficient resolve to recognize that there must be limits to government? Are we of that culture? I believe we are. And one of the interesting things about the events of this day, of course, is the significant attempts to deconstruct the civic religion. We called it the Anzac spirit, but really the spirit was already there. It was egalitarian. We were one people. We were all came from different and diverse backgrounds, but we were egalitarian. We were all equal. There was not a class in Australia. We have a classless society. We work together, we collaborate, we show individual initiative, we are resourceful, and we are a determined people. And all of these qualities need to again come to the fore to bring and restore proper and limited government to Australia. Anyway, your thoughts, please, Mark.
Then the town hall meeting approach would work well there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there'll already be a degree of cohesiveness. It won't be too chaotic or too splintered. And that's important. In America, you're going to have a little more of a splintering thing because of the way the mass media syndicate drives the idea of division, the left versus right thing, taken to the extreme. Mm-hmm. But if you look closely, you see that it's largely a facade. One example is Fox News is supposed to be this. Look at what they say closely. Say, oh, COVID, one of the terrible things COVID did was it made kids stay at home and they couldn't go to the public schools. And then the conservatives will say, well, you know, a child shouldn't be required to get the COVID so-called vaccination just to attend public school. We want to attend that public school, but we don't want to have that COVID jab requirement. But you look at them, you look at what they're saying and really analyze it, and you think just people's estimation, don't get the jab. Yet you still want to stick your kid in that public school. So one is a injection of a potentially deadly constitution. Some of the ideas in schools and the public school systems have actually been one of the reasons why constitutional government is so weak. This is one of the strange things. The left wing supports public schools. The right wing comes along and says, well, you shouldn't need the shot to go to public school, but let's have public schools nevertheless. And yet, so they both end up supporting the very school system that's responsible for major declines in America. The ability to read, the ability to reason, the lack of logic, the lack of proper political science, and the basic ideas of the country in which they're living that has a constitution. The leaders of yesteryear, going back to the 18th century, were far more erudite overall. Far more in command of the language, far more in command of political concepts, political science. You know, they weren't full of brain candy, all this celebrities and movies and escapist entertainment. Sure, we all like a football game once in a while or whatnot and, you know, have a cold one on a hot day, of course. But you don't want those things to rule or ruin your life. You know, they're not an end in themselves, nor should they be. And so, you know, we have a lot of potential, not just in Australia, but elsewhere. But I think in America, we would need, and there already is, but we need more of kind of a subculture, kind of create. Can you still hear me?
Yeah. Okay.
And kind of create a subculture that eventually restores the country to where it was. Because the media has done such a splintering effect on the country. So the actual Constitution Party presidential candidate here in America, Michael Peruca, said, "We finally had the public schools in America on the ropes with COVID. The tyrants did us a favor and we're blowing it. Why are we calling for returning to the public schools that we've been so soundly criticizing over the last 20, 30, 40 years? Because Johnny can't read anymore, because Johnny can't do arithmetic anymore, because Johnny doesn't know his constitution anymore. What are we doing? We're botching a robust homeschool and town hall meeting kind of subculture, if you will. I think it's the healthiest thing that could happen. Not a secession per se, but a, you might say, kind of a loose-knit citizen government. It wouldn't be government in the full official sense of the word, except to say that it would sort of fit into the mold of the doctrine of the lesser magistrates, a concept I've discussed on this show before, Arnie, yeah, where when the upper magistrates was to step into the gap and do what needs to be done, stop the evil, solve the problem. And a corollary of that could be to have, you know, because the public schools are refusing to do what needs to be done or to teach what needs to be taught, and that's feeding right into adult life and the mass media and all the falsehoods that are peddled there as well. And so we need to build on what COVID inadvertently did a favor for us, and that's put them out there, get them into public office, have town hall meetings, and push these tyrants and these ne'er-do-wells out of our way for good. You know, they're incorrigible. They don't want to take no for an answer. Well, they're good. A healthy concern here, mm-hmm, to put our foot down and say no more. Like I said a few minutes ago, I invited to these town hall meetings, not town hall meetings that they put on, that they arrange, town hall meetings that the people arrange. Do they dare step into the fray where real questions would be asked, where the media is not protecting them? And see what happens. See if they've got the nads, as they say, to step up to the plate and for once in their life speak to mind. I think you know, Arnie, there's a line under which, if society falls under a certain line, if there's a certain level of decline, you can't get it back. Okay, something bad's going to happen. Something's going to crash, and it's going to crash hard. And so, hold on. Be a time when we know what to do and when to do it. And I've said before, the time is now, right now.
Yeah. I agree with you, Mark. The time is exactly right now. And the fact is that the message has never been more timely. The point is that the public awareness of what's going on is growing. And to me, the idea of holding meetings, of holding public meetings, of actually sending speakers around to meet people and meet them in their kitchen table to discuss these things, let alone town halls. The league actually promotes the kitchen table meeting. I think it's important, mm-hmm, to meet with small groups, because the larger the group, of course, you can have 2 or 3 activists in the group and they can dominate the whole conversation, especially if the chair is part of the problem, not part of the answer. So the smaller the group is, to me, the most effective. But in the course of bringing these things up in discussion, what I really do enjoy about the travelling around Australia is the diverse points of view and the varying perspectives and the varying solutions. And in amongst that, one community might find that something works particularly well for their representative to exercise some influence. And to elevate that level of prowess is going to actually save you. Of course, that's never going to happen. What it is it's actually an active citizenry that can bring the politicians back to order. But in that course of it, it's not just a matter of loosely being active, but you've actually got to develop your thinking. You've got to develop your mind. When you touched on the civics, I'm pleased to report that I'm getting some assistance from a lady scanning in some very, very important Murdoch W.
Yeah.
Walter Murdoch was he was a statesman. A university was actually named after him in Western Australia. And interesting, 1930s, 1936, I think. And I've got in those boxes next to me is actually a certificate, original certificate that's going to be archived through the proper archives through libraries and the museums in Western Australia. They're already, well, we're going to add another five titles to that. One of them is The Australian Citizen. And the most important work is what Murdoch has written about. And I was pleased. I've read about half the book. It's a couple of hundred pages. Each of his five books is a couple of hundred pages. But I was pleased to read it. And responsibility. What is the correct relationship the citizen has towards government, and how should government operate? I find that particularly interesting in light of the fact that Augusto Zimmerman reinforced a lot of what Walter Murdoch wrote in his book. Augusto Zimmerman, in his Foundations of the Legal System of Law, which is advertised on our front page. There's no shortage of sources. There's no shortage of. What is lacking, if there is lacking, is political will. Individuals deciding to turn the box off and develop Australian legal system, history, theory and practice by Augusto Zimmerman. It is a first year law book. First year law, if you're doing it as your discipline in university, that is a recommended book for you to actually have as part of your library of information. They're not cheap, $139, but bear in mind that it is a law book and it is word accurate. So there's no typos, there's no misspelling, there's no ink reference text for a first year law student. And when you do read it, and I enjoyed reading it, what I pieced together that Augusto has placed there for research is I pieced together the civic duty and the development of common law, the development of the jury system, if you like, the habeas corpus of the century, the 9th and 10th century, Alfred the Great, who formed the nation of England. Alfred the Great, of course, won his campaigns, eventually won. He was defeated several times, but he eventually won. He defeated the Dane and decided, rather than to put the Danes to the sword, that they would make peace and they would allow the Danes to settle in parts of England under one nation, a common religion. The Danes were baptized into the Christian religion, and Alfred was the king, and he promulgated the laws as being around similar to the Ten Commandments. He used the scriptures in order to substantiate the law as just law. And of course, Alfred was astute enough to recognize that the people needed to ensure that the public received an education. So that, to me, the idea of educating the public is a very valid idea. As to allowing the monopoly of education to vest in the government or the bureaucracy, I don't agree with that. I don't, because I can see that the understanding of civics, they don't want you to have an understanding of how constitutionalism works, how it's a division of power, how federalism is a division of power. This limits the power of the Commonwealth, but federalism is where all other powers are vested in the state. That's the balancing of powers. Very, very important perspective. This is part of civics. This is part of our cultural history, and it's being withheld from us. So to me, the idea of the blue rinse discussing this, it's because of capacity. They have the time. It's the young who don't, who are so busy on the treadmill of life. They're busy processing their families, their mortgages, their debts, all those things, trying to establish themselves. And they're so, so busy. We can't expect them to take up this mantle. But it is the blue rinse, those that are secure. They're the ones that are most likely to be effective, because they have the the construction of the limiting powers of our Constitution, of the being held to account, of the role of the, dare I say it, public servant. How dare I say public servant? But that's what they are. The bureaucracy are public servants. And so are all those who work under the, to the Crown, the ministers. So all of these words mean something. They have a rich, their roots are richly embedded within the Christian tradition, within the Christian religion. Our Constitution is Trinitarian. It is based on the Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.